every human cell is undergoing around 20,000 intron removal or splicing events at any particular time, and there's about a trillion cells in the human body.
Okay.
So, yeah, these are very important proteins, and it's a major process. In the cell is this bag of stuff, right? So you've got chromosomes, massive chromosomes. You've got genes which are being transcribed. You've got the RNAs. You've got all the proteins being made, and many genes have got multiple introns.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some genes have got 50, 60 introns. Okay.
And would you ever get genes without introns?
Yes, so there are some genes without introns. But in
humans?
You get some in humans, but in humans the vast majority of genes are have introns, and the vast majority are alternatively spliced as well. You know? So just in this example there's five exons, so you've got four introns in between, and the introns again they've got to be very accurately removed. So exon sizes, they vary from, they can be even three or four nucleotides, right?
Mm-hmm.
But usually this is the kind of average size, 250, 300 nucleotides, which are these bases.
Yep.
Introns in usually have a minimum of about 60 nucleotides, but they can go up to tens or hundreds of thousands of nucleotides.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So these can be massive. Yeah. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So introns are—they don't actually do anything at all.
They're
just a scaffold.
Yes, they're degraded. They're degraded. But some introns, of course, code for other things, and so all introns are not rubbish. And then part of having introns can be to allow this alternative splicing, which we'll come to, but also to just regulate how genes are expressed, how fast they're expressed. There's one gene which where the coding sequence is only 0.7% of the length of the gene, and the gene is only basically transcribed once in a cell cycle because it's about 7 or 8 million base pairs long.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the time it's all transcribed, and that's required for how the cell works. Okay, so again, intron size can help to regulate how genes are expressed.
So it's not junk. I mean, I've seen the expression junk DNA. The introns aren't.
So that's something different again.
That's something different.
Yeah, because in the chromosome you've got genes which encode for proteins and other things, and then you've got all the junk DNA in the middle, but actually junk DNA is not junk.
It's no junk. But
that's what's, that again is something that's fairly new that's coming out. There's lots of other things that are being transcribed which aren't really recognized as genes, but these things can again regulate what happens to the proper, the real genes, if you know what I mean. And it happens huge amount, particularly in the brain. There's a lot of alternate splicing in the brain, where you might think it's such a complex organ, with I don't know how many different cell types and all the interaction, all the reactions it's got to do and stuff. Yeah, it's really important all these things are regulated. So there's a lot of alternate splicing in the brain. It's probably a story on its own, I would think. In many genes which are alternatively spliced, it's not all one kind or all the other kind. It's different amounts, And then as cells differentiate or external conditions change, like the plants or something, then the splicing patterns can alter. And maybe you need more of one type under to do a certain thing in certain conditions. So then that's regulated in that way.
Yeah. Okay.
So this is an example of a gene called DS-CAM. So it's a Drosophila gene, so yeah. fruit fly. So yeah. Fruit fly has got 13,000 genes in its genome.
Mm-hmm.
This one gene can make 38,000 different mRNAs and proteins.
Is that the record holder, then?
I would say that's probably probably the record holder, yeah. Yeah, and it does it because it's got these four alternative exons, as it's called, right? So in this case, there's 48 of these, and in any particular mRNA, there's only one of these 48 chosen.
Right.
And here, one of 12, one of 48, one of 33, one of 2. Multiply them all out, and you get this number. Right. So of course, most of them have never been detected around them because it's just such a major
job. It's really a mathematical exercise then. We know that there are 48 of those instead of here, so you do the
when the transcripts are cloned, then you see, okay, it's good, this one's got that one, or this one's got that one, or this one's got that one, you know, but these 38,000 will, it's a hard job to detect 38,000 different transcripts, you know. But the potential is there for all of them to be made.
Why would it need 38,000 variants of...
So the variants are needed for wiring of the nervous system. What happens is as a cell changes, or a cell differentiates from one cell or a stem cell into a particular cell type,
mm-hmm.
or as cells change in response to some kind of external conditions or stimulus, then loads of genes are transcription changes, you know, so the ultimate outcome is that you have a particular set of proteins in a cell at any particular time. When something changes, that protein set can change slightly or in a big way, right? And if the levels of all of these different proteins change in that way, which they will, then how they interact and how well they recognize one site versus another site will change, and that's what gives rise to the two differences in alternative splicing. So one cell, say a muscle cell versus a cartilage cell will have a completely different levels of these different proteins, so that all of the genes that have to be alternatively spliced will be spliced in slightly different ways. It's called combinatorial control. It's not well understood, but this is the model of how things happen. You know, how alternative splicing is changed in different cells and conditions.
You say it's not well understood, so presumably it's an area of active research.
And it's all about, so then what happens when splicing goes wrong? So about 15% of human mutations which are connected with disease are in splicing.
And is this something they discovered fairly recently as well?
This has been going on, but it's getting, as alternative splicing research goes up, there's more and more examples coming forward. Again, there's basically two classes of mutations. So one could affect a signal in the RNA, right? So if you have a mutation in the DNA splice site signal, then the RNA won't contain that signal. So it won't be recognized by a protein, or it'll be recognized less efficiently, or it'll be recognized by a different protein. That'll screw up the splicing. Or you can have a mutation in the gene which encodes for one of these proteins, so that the protein's either not made or a different version is made, and that again will screw up the splicing of the target genes. So there's, and depending what the mutation is, can give different disease phenotypes, either severe or mild. And the other side of this is that in many diseases, like cancers, all sorts of different types of cancers, alternative splicing of a lot of genes is changed, and the question is this cause or effect? You know, so there's,
and you don't know, are there any clues to the answer to that?
That depends. It depends on the disease. It depends on the gene. It depends how easily it's studied, how prevalent the mutations are. Right. You know, I mean, you know, very serious syndromes like muscular dystrophy, you know, receive a lot of funding, so there's a lot more done in that area than others, I would say.
Yeah.
But you know, there's lots and lots of diseases that are affected by that. Muscular dystrophy. So there's the Duchenne and the Becker. This is very severe, this is mild, and it depends. You know, basically here no protein is made, and here some protein is
really?
Made. And it's again a sort of splicing difference. Yeah. So there's a lot of gene therapy going on in this area, kind of interesting. Some cystic fibrosis patients have got splicing defects. I don't know what that one is. Parkinson's, other types of dementia. So these are all mutations in specific genes, right? So that the gene is disrupted, the protein's disrupted, and that's what's given rise to the disease. These are mutations in proteins that are involved in splicing, so spinal muscular atrophy, myotonic dystrophy, fascio-scapulohumeral muscular dystrophy. I'll show you a website with this stuff on. I already said that. So these are two examples. So I mean, we kind of try and target some of this stuff to we're trying to target it to clinicians who tend not to bring in alternative splicing, and in fact there's some you know, they don't really have diagnostics for some of these alternative splicing diseases. So if a clinician sees a patient, they can, you know, probably say, well, okay, this is probably a mutation in this gene or that gene or whatever. So then they take DNA from the patient, it gets sent to the lab, they sequence the gene. If they find a mutation which somebody else has, right, and they know what the effect of that mutation is, like a change in the protein sequence or something,
right,
then they can say to this patient, okay, you have this mutation which changes the protein sequence and whatever. But there's about a third of the sequences they get back, they can't say what the effect is, right, because they don't know what the mutation does. And it's likely that a number of those third affect the splicing. So there's a move to try and build up diagnostics in this area. And well, there's actually one of the people on here, Diana Barali, she's in Southampton, so she's a 50% clinician, 50% lab person. So she really does. And her father, who's Italian, he's also in this network. He does an awful lot of alternative splicing and disease. So this is basically our, you know, attempt at trying to give some examples.
Do you either talk to teachers or school kids, or do you use any materials at
that level? We haven't really done that.
I think it's probably too difficult.
I think it's time. I mean, this is only the funding I get from this is a fraction of what we get. Yeah, I thought that was quite that was quite reasonable.
Oh yeah.
Sorry,
what were you saying?
There's a lot of pressure from this from the EU funding of these networks to deliver the message, you know, to the general public
and to
researchers, and you know, but the amount of money I get on this, I mean, we've had we're in our fourth year. But we've had €40,000, €40,000, €40,000, €30,000, and €30,000. So, you know, you translate that into pounds before the euro got strong, you're talking £20,000 a year. So, it it hardly employs anybody, but the EU expectations are absolutely huge. And so, you know, our problem, we don't have the time, you know, we just got, you know, we're researchers, so yes, we should make the time. But of course, we have planned, there's 3 plant groups out of 40, okay? So the animal groups and the human groups, they do interact with patient groups and whatever. And there's a number of, I'm trying to think even if they're on here, but this is a quick look at what's in. So if you have a mutation in here somewhere in this region, right, in the DNA, it can block the production. This is a normal protein. But a mutant protein, you know, could sort of look something like this, right? And this gives you the Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which is very severe. Sometimes if you have a mutation, you can end up having, some exon skipped, which means that, you know, part of the protein is missing, right? So you're still making protein, but it's not the full protein. So this gives the Becker muscular dystrophy, which is, you know, a much milder symptoms. Mm-hmm. Right? So the question is, if you have a mutation in the gene which upsets the splicing, right, which gives rise to Duchenne, yeah, can you put something into the cells which then modifies the splicing and puts it back into frame? Do you know what in frame means?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, alright. So if you have a mutation that puts the mRNA out of frame, right, then you lose the frame for the protein and you'll end up making a short protein, which is crap, right?
Yeah.
So if you have one of those kinds of mutations, and there'll be like a splicing mutation. So say there's a splicing mutation there, right, which may cause this kind of skipping, mm-hmm. right, which puts it out of frame.
Mm-hmm.
What you might be able to do is you can look at the sequence and determine, you know, what you might be able to do. If you can then put your trans factor, right, whatever you're going to use in trans, which blocks that splicing and makes this splice to here, but that puts it back into frame,
Great. Then
you will make the protein even though parts are missing. Great. And this will alleviate the symptoms. So people with Duchenne, so it will help. It will help muscle development to a greater extent than they can do on their own. Great. And that's what Danny Shumpoli has done. He's found that you kind of come into a kind of close-up, you know. If you want to disrupt this splicing, you can, the English guy has been using a small piece of RNA that would base pair to this, so that blocks that,
mm-hmm.
and then the splicing will go to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Danny has done something slightly different, where he has a small stable RNA, which, on which he's put a site for a protein that would promote splicing, right? So the small RNA binds there, he's got a protein binding site there, that promotes splicing to there. So by that you can change whatever mutation a person has, you can either change it by blocking or change it by promoting the splicing. And they've done mouse models with this, so put it into mice, which have got mutation in that gene, and these mice are viable and can move around far better than, you know, the ones that have the equivalent of the Duchenne can hardly move, they just lie on there. So he had films of that, but I doubt if that's... Plants get much less money for research than animals, so we are a good way behind. So what we're still involved in actually discovering alternative splicing. So one thing we do is try and find new alternative splicing events. Then we look at how they're regulated in plants by looking at these proteins that affect alternative splicing, and then we can also look at alternative splicing and how it changes under different conditions, so obviously under stress conditions. And so we have a, I don't think it's on me. So in plants it's about discovery, it's about being able to measure changes and then trying to work out what those changes mean. And we are in the sort of first and second phase of that, I would say. So here's an example in plants that might be of interest. It's not really alternative splicing, but it's a mutation that affects splicing, right? And this is what gives sticky rice, right? So it's a granule-bound starch synthase that makes starch, right, in cereals. And if in the normal, you would have this splicing event joining this exon to that exon, giving you the fully functional starch synthase, right?
Yep.
So it just makes normal starch. If you have a mutation in the intron and generates this sequence, this can be selected as well as the normal.
Mm-hmm.
And in it's actually temperature dependent, so in much, I can't remember which, either more or less, you get more of this made, and this protein means you get much lower levels of GBS, and that makes the rice go sticky. I can explain that better, but that's an example of that people will know, because you have your nice fluffy rice, or you have your glutinous ball. So we use Arabidopsis. I mean, this is how we monitor cells, but basically we get bands on a gel, but we do it on a DNA sequencing machine so we can see these fragments. So these are alternatively spliced mRNAs from the same gene. So you can see in flower you've got these two types, in leaf you've got these two types, in root you've only got a single one. You make the RNA, then you copy the RNA, this reverse transcription, and then you do PCR, which people will be more aware of, and that gives you the signals that you can then detect. And you do the PCR and include a fluorescent label, which is what the machine actually detects. So we can look at 300 alternative splicing events in different plant genes. It's only a small fraction, obviously, but that's what we're looking at. And in plants, in this plant called Arabidopsis, which is this scabby little weed that grows everywhere, you can make mutants. It's very easy to cause them to have mutations, and because the genome sequenced, it's easy to find out where the mutation is. So these are mutations in proteins which are involved in nonsense-mediated decay. And the numbers are quite scary, because we look at this number of events, we find this number of products, but we only expect to see about 450 products. And we've got 150. Oh no, that's not true. We've got 700 products, 150 of those are turned over by MND. So that means that all the time there are transcripts being made, which are being turned over rapidly by, why are they being made? In some cases it's to regulate the expression of the gene. We can get a bit too complex here.
Why did you say that was scary? say the failures are scary?
Because you kind of don't expect, well, maybe you do expect this, I suppose the question is, if things are being turned over all the time, you know, why are they being made in the first place, right?
So is it mistakes that are being committed,
so,
or is it?
So one is mistakes, and the other is there will be examples of regulation. So, so this is... This is a gene which regulates the clock in plants, right? So, you know, humans have got circadian clocks, yep. Plants have them, so on. So this is one of the genes that does this. And again, you can see there's these two products, and in the wild type, there's very little of this product made, and in the mutants, then this goes up in the NMD mutant. So this says that this transcript is turned over by NMD. And what actually happens is that in the normal, or at a particular time, well, what this protein does is it increases and decreases on a sort of 12-hour cycle, something like this. So it's a clock protein, so it helps to regulate all the other things that happen in the cell, so it knows, you know, when to stop doing something and start doing something else. And so at the stage where the level of the protein is going up, right, you have the majority of splicing goes like this, and it makes the mRNA, which makes the protein. Right? So then the protein level is going up and up and up. And as it goes up, then it can it binds to the pre-mRNA. Right? And the more of the protein that's made, the more that binds to all these different molecules. And that changes the alternative splicing from this site to this site, which makes a transcript which has a stop codon and is degraded by NMD. So the net result of that is you make far less of the mRNA and thereby far less of the protein, you know. So that's what generates the cycle, you know. So you make loads of protein till you get to such a point that basically you send all the splicing down this way, so then you lose the protein level, so it drops again. Yeah, and then as the protein level drops, you get less and less of this interaction, so you start to make more and more of that. So it's a little oscillator, exactly. Yeah. And that's alternative splicing regulation. So So we found 150 transcripts that are turned over by NMD. Of those, there's bound to be some that are regulatory. Right. But which ones? Why? Each one of those would take 3 or 5 years to...
Each of the 150?
Yeah, if you want to analyze them all, yeah, you've got to go right back to the gene. You've got to, you know... For this story, there's a woman in Germany. She's been working on this for easily 5 or 6 years, and has got some great stuff. But you know, this is one gene. And she works on the clock, which is how she came to be working on that particular protein.
So
it's a huge challenge.
Right, when you say it's scary, what you've made
Yeah, part of it is how the hell are we ever going to get to the bottom of it. You know? But you know, these are although very basic, these are the kinds of things that regulate what happens to plants in the field, you know, yield. What time, you know, when do barley plants flower, you know, how long they flower for, all these kinds of things.
What is driving you? What are you, I mean, you personally, what is it that you're trying to find out? What are you interested in? Or are you just...
So actually, I'm interested in the splicing process and how it's regulated. Now, all the biochemistry that I've talked about, these 200 proteins, that's all done in humans and yeast because it's actually easier to do, and there's far more groups doing it, you know. So
yeah.
And they have particular systems which have not been developed in plants. So we have one or two advantages, like the mutants in Arabidopsis, so that's our advantage. So we're interested in really how things are regulated. So that's why we've taken the route of saying, okay, we want to look at alternative splicing on not just a gene, single gene basis, but broader. How can we do it? Well, we can do that by looking at 300 different events. What happens to those events if you change one of the regulatory proteins? You know, does, if you change a particular regulatory protein, do you actually affect them all, or do you affect only a small subset? In what way do you affect them? You know, so we can answer those kinds of questions. So there's a number of, you know, regulatory proteins that have been isolated in plants, and we can look at that. That's exactly what we're doing at the moment. So this is in Arabidopsis, but we also have to work on barley here. So you know, we're now going to transfer that system to look at barley in a much more specific thing, like you know, like cold. What happens in the cold? You know, so we know that there's a whole bunch of genes that are turned on and off in the cold, but there's also a lot of alternative splicing going on, which will change the function of different genes. So that's what we'll look at.
Commercial interests in this?
No, I would say not. It's pure research, and you know, unless we really find, if we find a key gene in the cold response or some other response is alternatively spliced in a certain way, which if that splicing was changed, would either give better protection or help the plant or something, then that would be a possibility. Mm. And there, you know, there's work not involved in splicing, but there's work on particular genes. I think Monsanto something's been in field trial that gives drought resistance, and you know, there are things on, you know, on the books, but yeah, but basically it's very hard to predict what you can do to make the plants better if you don't understand what's going on.
Right.
Because you could isolate one gene and think, okay, well this does this and this, you know, and then you put it into plants and you find, well, this is the problem with the Monsanto, somebody's telling me about this. They have a gene which is drought resistant, and in severe drought it gives a 20% increase in yield. Oh no, it gives a normal yield in severe drought conditions, mm-hmm. So it's giving drought tolerance. Mm-hmm. But in normal conditions, you have a 20% loss of yield, all right? So it's a system that's there to help the plant back itself up in bad conditions, right?
Yeah.
But the net effect is if you don't have bad conditions, it's not as good as the normal stuff.
Right.
And that, you can't predict that. You just can't predict it. So you think, great, you do all your tests, you get the stuff out in the field, and it's only once you've done 3 or 4 years of field trials at different conditions in different places that you actually find out and say, well, you know, if we knew it was going to be bad every year, you know, who knows, maybe you can sell it to Morocco or something like that, where they know that they're going to always have those conditions, you know, but but if you don't understand things, it's really difficult to predict what to do to address things that go on.
Yeah. So SCRI, is that part of the University of Dundee?
No, it's a Scottish Government Institute.
It's a government thing. Yeah. And presumably they're funding it because they're interested in practical applications.
There is more practical, more applied type of research at SCRI, but there's still basic stuff. I mean, there's a lot of pathology, so, you know, Phytophthora that caused the potato famine in Ireland is still just a massive world problem. not just potatoes, but tomatoes, peppers, all this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge area of research. And again, it's about understanding how the pathogen infects the plant and how the plant responds to the pathogen and either kills the pathogen or succumbs, you know. And that ties into potato breeding, how you can make better resistant potato plants, which ties into the guys that went collecting wild potatoes in the 30s and 40s and 50s in Peru and whatever, you know. So you've got these wild potatoes,
yeah,
and they have disease resistance genes because they're wild, they have to have them to survive. Whereas, you know, when the plant breeding, you know, they've been breeding and breeding for bigger potatoes and all this kind of stuff, and they include whatever resistance is around,
right.
But the pathogen can change so quickly.
Yeah.
So you can have this great cultivar that goes and makes a fortune for 5 years, and the next year, you know, so again, the challenge in the breeding is you've got continually to have things coming through with different, you know, disease resistance. So, you know, people go to the supermarket and just decide to have those tatties or those bacon tatties and stuff, but what's behind it is huge.
Yeah. The thing is just far more complex than anyone ever imagined, and yeah, it's highly promise of if you understood the DNA, you were always there.
Yeah, no, that's really blown out of the water.
Is it?
Yeah, completely blown out of the water.
Yeah.
So, because, like you said, junk DNA, so now it's now reckoned that a lot of that junk DNA is being transcribed into RNAs, which are just turned over all the time. But some of them aren't, you know. And in some conditions, they may not be turned over as quick and have other effects, you know. And that's just completely unknown, you know. So, and then, you know, we've been talking about gene to mRNA to protein, but there's all sorts of other things that go on to affect that system. There are things called microRNAs, which are 20 nucleotides long. They specifically target mRNAs and destroy them. Right? So if you have an mRNA being produced and then some condition comes along and microRNA is produced, all of a sudden you lose that. Right? But that gene can still be making the transcript. Right? So the gene, the production of the transcript hasn't changed, but the protein level goes right down because this little microRNA comes up and starts to hit it. You know? And we've got examples of that, completely different kind of RNA, completely different kind of function, and we found that one or two of them can also hit messenger RNA. So these are completely different RNA pathways for doing completely different things in the cell, and all of a sudden we've got two or three examples that have kind of crossed. So they've made this pathway, but they're functioning this pathway. And there's going to be a lot of those things happening. So, you know, and that, again, huge in human disease. You know, a lot of these RNAs change in levels in different cancer cells. The question is, are any of them the cause of the cancer, or are they just an effect of the change in the cell metabolism? I think the message is you can't fund applied science only, because if you do, you don't have any science to apply, you know. So you have to have this huge amount of basic research from which things will come, you know. And you know, all the drugs that are being developed for against different diseases and all that, it all comes from because somebody knows that this particular protein works in this particular pathway, right? And if you can knock that protein out, then you no longer, or in a disease, this protein has changed its function to do Y instead of X, right? So if you can block it from doing Y, then you have a drug against that disease,
and that's what all the drug discovery is about.
It's such a, what you just said there, it's such a difficult idea to get across to non-scientific politicians and decision makers.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they're only interested in applied.
Yeah. Well, they want to see outcomes. They want to say, well, we've done it. Or they want to cover their backs and say, you know, okay, the next outbreak of foot and mouth. Well, we've been funding research in the whatever, the modern research on the foot and mouth virus, and we've been funding, just so they can say they've been doing something, you know, what comes out of it then, you know, so, yeah, it's a tough one, it is tough, but
it's a message that, I mean, that's one of the reasons that I wanted to do all this. I want to get the kids when they're young and impressionable and they can actually understand and get them into thinking as scientists.
Yes.
I've seen them doing it in primary school.
Yeah.
I've seen kids involved in really sophisticated discussions about energy efficiency and climate change and all these sort of things. Primary 6 and primary 7. There's a lot more really interesting stuff going on in the primary schools now. Then in the secondaries, the secondary teachers, science teachers are quite conservative and they're still doing the traditional methods. Although they're
getting them through the exams.
But again, the new curriculum should help that as well, should broaden it a wee bit. But kids can understand science. Kids are really interested in science at primary school. You're turned off at the moment in first and second year.
Yeah.
And then what you get is a small minority who are the science enthusiasts, the scientists of the future. Colleagues and the rest of them just drift off and become politicians and make daft decisions about funding science.
So your ASNet are going to make a game for kids.
Are they?
With letters
to
make one word versus the other word to do alternative splicing.
They're doing that just now.
It's being developed at the moment by this woman in Vienna.
The one you mentioned?
Andrea Barta, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's what happened.
Yeah. So she can... We have written a couple of just short articles for different things on the new grants. So she's in this new grant, the stress grant as well. So she wrote something recently for... so she does the public understanding of science for Erasnet.
For Erasnet.
And I do the website. So the plant people got royally shafted, you know, so we have all this crap to do. This, however, that's how it goes.
Yeah. Okay.
I love coming to work, so that's, you know.
Good
see
stuff.
The outputs, I get happy about it, so good results.
So you've got separate one, have you?
So this is who I would use, but the Institute has got a PI first, so they might be really interested in the website or producing. Like I said, I reckon you could without really digging, you could easily get, you know, a dozen stories from the plant science group here and SCRI that would be of general interest. You know, so it's a real, but it, you know, it'd be the same everywhere you go. You go to Glasgow or Edinburgh or whatever, there'd be loads of stuff. But if you have somebody who's like a PR person, then that helps. That would help point you in the right direction. Maybe. Not convinced.
Sure. Would it be possible to send me a copy of that PowerPoint?
Yeah, sure.
Is that something you want to?
No,
it's fine.
Email me it's that? Fine. Yeah, I can email it to you.
That was useful.
Great. Yeah, no, I can do that.
Okay.
And you can look at the website and stuff on there as well. Yeah, I mean, I think gene therapy is probably a concept that, I don't know if it's in the curriculum for secondary school.
Just not at the moment.
But, you know, when you actually have an example, I mean, if you see the video of the mice, right, the one that has the muscular dystrophy and the one that has the corrected muscular dystrophy, mm-hmm. It's really impressive.
Did you see it, Steve Jones, the geneticist, talking about just a few weeks ago, and he was saying that they're doing it all wrong, and maybe we should rethink the whole thing about sequencing the DNA. And welcome. Give him a hard time for doing that. They're funding enough a lot.
Yeah. They're sequencing individuals, aren't they?
Uh-huh.
And but you know, this is it's where it's going to stop. As sequencing gets so cheap and doable, then you know, they're talking about personalized medicine. Each individual with their full sequence, and you know, you can predict whether you're going to get whatever cancer, whatever time. You know, I'm not sure I really want to go down that line.
I mean, what he was saying was really that idea of one gene, one effect is gone, and really hundreds of thousands of times.
Yes, so that's right.
The idea of personalized medicine maybe isn't going to fossil.
Not without much greater understanding of all
the
genes, yeah. So if it's
the stuff you're talking about.
Yeah, if it's one gene that causes if it's a particular mutation that causes a particular disease, you can see whether you've got it or not, or mm-hmm. might have it. You know, like, well, Huntington's comes on at age 25 or something like mm-hmm. that. So, you know, you might actually want to know if you're going to, you know, if you're in danger, if it's in the family,
yeah.
you want to know whether you're going to get it or not, because that might make, because I have a friend whose mother had Huntington's, so he said he would not have any children, and he hasn't had any children, you know, and he made that informed decision when he was about 21 or something like that, when he saw the deterioration in his mother, you know, he just thought, no, I'm not going to do that to anybody. But it allows people to make those kinds of decisions. But, you know, the other side, I don't know much about this, but the other side is then insurance companies.
Yeah.
They look and they say,
you've got that,
so you're going to get breast cancer or something,
yeah.
so you'll be paying, you know,
times
what anybody else. So that's not true.
So you're better not getting the information in the first place.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. All right. Well,
thanks for taking the time to
welcome.
Talk to me. That was interesting. I know an awful lot more than I did before.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, good. But like I say, I think there's loads of stuff here, so, you know.